Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, coming up on this Tuesday edition. Hot heat in the Southwest. Very dangerous temperatures coming up this week. Americans and money, it's not good news. Not handling it very well. And also, are you a sugar addict? It's easy to be addicted to the sweet stuff in a variety of forms. It's good to get off of it. Some tips on how to kick the habit from a nutritionist. That and more coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. We are at 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link also at thetrumpet.com. You can listen there. Variety of locations. Also, the TuneIn app is a good place to listen if you're on the go and you have a smart device. So you can use the TuneIn app and just search for KPCG, and we'll come up right there. Also, of course, all the programs archived online at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. I'm Dwight Falk. Thanks for joining me today here on Trumpet Radio Live. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at KPCGFM. And if you'd like to send an email in, please send those to comments@kpcg.fm. We're happy to check those out for you. Hopefully you're having a good Tuesday. Hot here in a lot of places in the United States, and especially hot in the Southwest. Dangerously hot coming up today and this week. Weather.com reports this. Dangerously hot temperatures are gripping the Southwest this week, potentially threatening the all-time record high temperature in both Las Vegas and Phoenix. So we have listeners online at kpcg.fm in quite a few places around the world, including those locations. And if you've ever been out to Vegas or Phoenix, you know it is hot. It's not like they're not used to the heat, but this is going to be even hotter than normal. They say a large dome of high pressure in the upper atmosphere has developed over the Southwest. Beneath the dome, sinking air is causing temperatures to soar well over 110 degrees in many areas. There were some stories about the heat out there. There's some fires that have occurred because of it. Also, air conditioners are running at their highest levels. And, of course, a lot of cases breaking down. So there's a lot of news stories about how busy those companies are. And when it gets that hot, you have to have air conditioning. You can't very well survive without it, I don't think, particularly the old and the young. So very hot out there. Phoenix, highs are going to reach or exceed 115 degrees through at least midweek. Daily record highs will be within reach. So we're talking about some of the hottest temperatures in recorded history. 116 degrees for Tuesday and 115 for Wednesday. That's what they're looking at potentially. Phoenix could approach its all-time record high of 122 degrees. You heard that right, 122 degrees. That record was set on the 26th of June back in 1990. And so today there's a chance it could get up near that. It will also be within reach of tying the record for consecutive days of high temperatures, greater than 115 degrees. And temperatures at night, what's it going to cool down to? Upper 80s and 90s. So extremely hot there in Phoenix, California, not much better. Central Valley, triple-digit heat in Bakersfield, other places. Southern California, going to be hot in the deserts, 110 to 120. It's always hot there, but exceptional heat this time of year, I guess, and this week. And in Nevada, as mentioned, Las Vegas, temperatures are forecast to be 110 degrees or hotter through the week. And then Reno, very hot as well. Here's something that's interesting about it getting this hot. I didn't know this could happen, but apparently flights can be canceled. Flights can be delayed or canceled if temperatures of 115 or more are present due to the loss of lift that planes need to fly. So learning something about flying, I didn't know that that mattered. I guess it's pretty obvious that it does now that I stop and think about it. But so when it gets that hot, people could be delayed at the airports. And so everybody's a little cranky when it gets that warm and going to be even crankier now if you miss your flight or if you're delayed, and hopefully the air conditioners are working on those planes. And you know how it is, too, when you, a lot of times when you land or right before you take off, it's a little warm on the plane for a while. So hopefully things go well there if people are flying in and out of some of those locations. But very dangerous heat coming up in the Southwest this week. Here in Oklahoma City, Edmond area, it's not going to be that bad. I think we're in the low 90s today, so nowhere near that extremely hot temperature. A few other headlines to look at today. Of course, you probably heard on the news update at the top of the hour, news out of North Korea. The family of an American college student who died days after being released from North Korea in a coma. So the 22-year-old had completed his journey home. He came home, of course, in a comatose state. He's a college student. He had gone to North Korea on a tour, which is surprising that they would offer that. And they've canceled those tours now, by the way, the company that was doing them. And it doesn't seem like it'd be smart to go over there, unless you're Dennis Rodman. Apparently he can come and go as he pleases, but otherwise people have a hard time going to that area. And so this fellow, he came home in a coma. You probably saw all the headlines and the news stories about that. And then, of course, he died. Otto Warmbier died on Monday, relatives said in a statement, and they did not cite a specific cause of death. Doctors had described Warmbier's condition as a state of unresponsive wakefulness. If you saw the video, it was really strange. They were walking with him, a person on each arm. And he was walking, I think, but he wasn't conscious, didn't appear to be with it, I guess, as you would say. And so he had this difficult, severe neurological injury. North Korea claimed it was one thing, botulism, I believe. And the doctors here in the U.S. said they didn't think that was the case. He arrived in Ohio on June 13th after being held for more than 17 months. The University of Virginia student was accused of trying to steal a propaganda banner while visiting with a tour group and was convicted of subversion. So if you saw the video of him in court, he was begging for mercy and blaming the U.S. government. And you can, you know, you've probably have seen video like that before where clearly people are under duress. They're not speaking freely. They're, you know, probably reading a script or something that was prepared. That happens oftentimes. And it was just a really terrible scene. And so he was put before the North Korean officials and journalists for this televised confession that was aired. And so just a horrible thing. In February 2016, Warmbier was presented to media by North Korean authorities when he acknowledged and apologized for this alleged crime. What does that crime, what kind of a sentence does it bring? 15 years in prison with hard labor, because apparently he took a poster. Whether or not he did it, I don't know. But pretty harsh sentence there, and of course he ended up dying. His family said that it was told he had been in a coma since soon after his sentencing. So President Trump came out and said, of course, it's a terrible situation, terrible regime over there, which it is. And the tour company that took Otto Warmbier to North Korea is now stopping trips for Americans. So that seems like a good idea. It doesn't seem like anybody from the United States would want to go over there. You know, you think about North Korea, Iran, some of those areas that are very hostile to the West that seem to really prize getting hostages from America. I don't know why people would want to go over there. But maybe it's the thrill of it. I'm not sure. There are more Americans being held there in North Korea. I think at least three. And so don't know about them or what the situation is there. But there are still some Americans that are over there. Of course, North Korea is a threat in a lot of ways on many levels, including with their nuclear program. Here's a soundbite from Rafael Wober. This is from General Joseph Dunford, rather, the top U.S. military officer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Monday, he was talking, and he reiterated the U.S. concerns over North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And here is what he had to say regarding North Korea and their nuclear program.
First of all, to the question, do I view it as a threat? I do. It's clear to me that Kim Jong-un, the regime, is on a path of attempting to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile and matching that with a nuclear warhead that can reach the United States. We should be concerned about that, and we are. The primary means of dealing with that is diplomatic and economic pressure, a campaign led by Secretary Tillerson.
And so, again, that was General Joseph Dunford. He's a top U.S. military officer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that was on Monday when he was talking about the U.S. concerns over North Korea's nuclear program. Of course, there are concerns there, and he said that their best the best bet is sanctions and so forth. It hasn't done a lot yet, hasn't really solved too much, but that's what they're talking about continuing to do, and clearly just a terrible regime over there. Another story that's been big and will be big here in the months to come is the Brexit. There's a lot that's written about that on thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and check that out. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show has a lot of programs about that that you should check out thetrumpet.com if you haven't heard all of those. You can get them at kpcg.fm as well. But UK Chancellor Philip Hammond said on Tuesday negotiations on the UK's withdrawal from the European Union had a positive start, but he warned that it will get tougher as these negotiations go on. Here are some of his comments.
And I'm confident we can do a Brexit deal that puts jobs and prosperity first, that reassures employers that they will still be able to access the talent they need, that keeps our markets for goods and services and capital open, that achieves early agreement on transitional arrangements so that trade can carry on flowing smoothly and businesses up and down the country and across the continent can move on with investment decisions that they want to make but that have been on hold since the referendum. So how do we achieve this Brexit for Britain? Firstly, by securing a comprehensive agreement for trade in goods and services. Secondly, by negotiating mutually beneficial transitional arrangements to avoid unnecessary disruption and dangerous cliff edges. Thirdly, by agreeing frictionless customs arrangements to facilitate trade across our borders and, crucially, to keep the land border on the island of Ireland open and free-flowing. Our departure from the EU is underway, but ensuring that it happens via a smooth pathway to a deep and special future partnership with our EU neighbours, one that protects jobs, prosperity and living standards in Britain, will require every ounce of skill and diplomacy that we can muster. Yesterday was a positive start. It will get tougher. But we are ready for the challenge and confident that we can deliver for British jobs, British business, and British prosperity. Last year, we grew faster than any other major advanced economy bar Germany. Business has created 3.4 million more private sector jobs, and that's even if we count George Osborne just once.
So a little attempt at humor there, I guess, by UK Chancellor Philip Hammond that was on Tuesday talking about negotiations on the UK's withdrawal from the European Union. And it's going to get tougher, he says. He made the comments after three members of the bank's Monetary Policy Committee voted to increase the bank's benchmark rate from a record low 0.25 at their last meeting. Britain's inflation rate rose to 2.9% in May, the highest in nearly 4 years. And so as he mentioned in that soundbite there, the economy has been growing, at least on some, by some measure. Germany's has been growing more. So, and like he said, Philip Hammond said, well, they hope that they can have this nice partnership with these other EU nations. Don't think that's going to work out very well for them, but that's their hope anyway. So there's a lot more about that at the trumpet.com that you can get into. German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday also talked about the Brexit, and she said she hopes for a good agreement after Brexit talks in which other EU countries will listen carefully to what Britain wants, but also defend their own interests. So that's obviously where you're always going to have a problem when there's two parties that are trying to negotiate something. Everyone wants what's in their best interest. And so then there's going to be divisions. There's going to be breakdowns at some point. Merkel spoke in Berlin at a joint news conference with Romanian President Klaus Iohannis, who also stressed the other 27 EU countries' unity. So they're trying to have those other 27 nations have this show of unity anyway. in dealing with the UK. And the EU wants to discuss divorce terms before moving on to the shape of the future relations with Britain, and said views with talks with informed optimism. Hopefully those will occur. That's what they're hoping there in the EU anyway. So they continue to talk about that, and there's a lot that has to go into it, pretty in depth, but they're trying to get started on that in some cases. So make sure you check out thetrumpet.com, and you can search for the Brexit. There's a lot of write-ups about that, and also some Trumpet Daily radio programs and some videos too. So it'll give you a lot more information on what you can expect to see happening over there in Europe and in the UK. A couple of sports notes here that are somewhat interesting, I think. You might remember that in the last several years, the NFL football team, the Washington Redskins, came under quite a bit of scrutiny, I guess, because of their name. Some people feel Redskins is an offensive name. Obviously, it's talking about Indians. But that's been their name for quite some time, and there was thoughts on both sides of the argument. Well, the Supreme Court weighed in. Redskins get Supreme Court win on team name controversy. The Washington Redskins have been in a battle over their controversial team name for years, and Monday brought a big victory for the team. According to the Associated Press, the Supreme Court said the government can't refuse to register trademarks that are considered offensive. And so this ruling applies to, of course, a lot of situations, including the Redskins. I think there was some sort of a musical group, if you want to call them that, a rock band of some kind, that they had a name that I think was also considered offensive. But again, they say, well, the Supreme Court said just because people might find it offensive, the government can't refuse to register trademarks. So that's the Supreme Court's ruling. So the Washington Redskins will not be forced to change their name or anything else, I guess. Now, they could still, of course, but the Supreme Court will not make them. So that's interesting. That had been a big controversy with the Redskins. It's been a controversy on local level as well. A lot of different high school sports teams, they had to change. I don't know if they had to, but they chose to change their mascots and their names in a lot of cases, particularly from parts of the country where there was a lot of, say, Indian names. A lot of those teams did change their names. But the Supreme Court has weighed in and said that they do not have to. So the Washington Redskins, I guess, will remain the Washington Redskins. Here's another note related to football. Maybe a little humorous. People take their football very seriously, of course. This appealed to me because I'm a Packer fan. I have friends that are Bears fans, so I think Packers and Bears fans will find this interesting. It says, Packer fan to sue the Bears. That's right. He's going to sue the organization, the Chicago Bears. Should the Chicago Bears have the right to deny field access from fans wearing opposing colors? Green Bay Packers fan Russell Beckman doesn't think so, and he's taking the Bears to court over his right to wear green and gold at Soldier Field. So, of course, you can go to a stadium and wear, I think, any uniform you want. You might be heckled by if you're in the visiting stadium. But this is more about getting actually down on the playing field. At issue is an incident from this past season. Though he's an unabashed Packers fan, Beckman has owned a personal seat license at Soldier Field and season tickets for Bears games since 2003. He has also taken part of the ETH experiences, if I'm saying that right, the STH experiences. I'm not sure what that is. It's a program, anyway, that the team offers to fans who rack up rewards points for different purchases. And that's offered with a lot of things, of course. You can get, you know, rewards points for your credit card and other things. This is a particular rewards package, I guess, that the Bears are doing. For the past three seasons, Beckman said he spent his rewards points on a chance to stand at the edge of the field during pregame warmups, which would be kind of neat. You can go down there and get close to the players, see how big they are. I guess listen to their whatever they say before the game. It'd be pretty exciting if you're a fan. And so he goes down on Soldier Field and he stands on the field, but he wore his Packer gear during 2014 and 2015 trips. And he said he was denied field access when he wore Green Bay colors for last December's game between the oldest rivals in the NFL. So he was smart, I guess. He's a Packers fan. He wanted to go down there when the Packers were warming up with the Bears. And a pretty neat opportunity. And the Soldier Field said, no, we don't want to let you down here because you're wearing Packer colors. So that's the controversy. Beckman appealed to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. He hasn't heard back from him. I guess the commissioner has bigger fish to fry, as they say. And Beckman then decided to take legal action against the team. So he is suing the Chicago Bears. He says the Bears have deprived, this is his quote, they've deprived me of my ability to fully enjoy this specific on-field experience and the general experience of the Bears-Packers game at Soldier Field. And he's going to represent himself in court. So that typically doesn't go very well when people try to represent themselves. I don't know if he'll be wearing a Packer uniform when he does it. But at any event, he is going to press ahead with that lawsuit. Don't know what will come of it. But if we hear, we'll pass it on. I don't know if any of our listeners are ever going to get down on the field like that. But I guess you have to be careful what colors you wear. There was a lot of comments to this, of course. Packers-Bears rivalry is a big thing in football. But this is an interesting comment from somebody that read the article, and they posted a comment that says, so it's all right to show disrespect toward the flag, the national anthem, and by extension to every man and woman who served in uniform, both living and dead. But support one team over another? No, that's beyond the pale. So weighing in there. And I thought this was an interesting comment because it is interesting how, you know, there's been that controversy in the NFL of some people not standing for the national anthem. And because of that, of course, stirring up quite a bit of controversy. But the NFL has allowed that. They've allowed people to not stand for the national anthem, to disrespect the country in that way. And even though the people doing it, I guess, say they're not, but that's kind of a convoluted thinking, I guess. But then in this other case, they're going to be more severe or take a stronger action against a person wearing a different uniform. So not to say that the Bears should let them down there. That's probably their business one way or the other. But it is interesting how the priorities seem to get a little bit turned around with some things. So that was an interesting comment, I thought, on that story. Packers fan to sue the Bears. It's probably not the first time that's happened and probably won't be the last. If you are flying, which a lot of people are during the summer for business or sometimes for a vacation, and you're feeling like getting one of their drinks, usually they're still free, I think, at this point, you might want to stay away from coffee or tea. So I know we've had a lot of people traveling here, even locally, and coming in for a conference here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, where we're broadcasting from. So hopefully people didn't take the coffee or tea during the flight, because they say it's probably not a good idea to do that. You may want to think twice, they say, this is from Business Insider, before you order that English breakfast blend, according to cabin crew members. So they're getting their information from people that actually work on the flights. What would they do? What would they drink? What would they have? And what would they avoid? Flight attendants, they say, will not drink hot water on the plane. They will not drink plain coffee, and they will not drink plain tea. So obviously, if they're getting bottled water, that's a different story. They don't want to get the hot water coming out of the plane. And they'll put that in, again, these teas and coffees in a lot of cases. They say, why the self-imposed ban on delicious warm beverages? Well, according to a 2004 EPA sample of 158 planes, 13% contained coliform bacteria. Two of the airplanes were found to have dangerous E. coli in the water. And as Business Insider reported, an additional EPA study found that one in every eight planes fails the agency's standards for water safety. So that was 158 planes that they checked. And the EPA said that, of course, one in every eight failed their standards of water safety. And I don't even know if their standards necessarily are that high. They probably are on some level, but a lot of planes are not even passing those standards. They say water on board is regulated by the EPA to ensure safe drinking water on the aircraft. The Association of Flight Attendants pushed for this regulation over 15 years ago. The regulation gives broad discretion to airlines on how often they must test the water and flush the tanks. They do not believe this regulation goes far enough or is sufficiently enforced. So they do find bacteria in the water pretty often that's not good for you. The bacteria is likely delivered while the water is in transit, according to NBC. So obviously the water has to get on the plane from some location. They're transporting it. I'm not sure how they do it, if it's in tanker trucks or how they get it out there. But they say there's bacteria in those. And of course, if they're not flushing the planes often enough or the systems often enough, you know, you could get some issues in there. According to a 2015 study in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, more microorganisms exist in the transport vehicles than in the water's original source. And so they can see that transferring the organisms from the truck to the plane occurs. Dr. Cedric Spack, an infectious disease specialist at Baylor University Medical Center, told NBC that people with a compromised immune system should steer clear of the in-flight beverage. He additionally noted that people with infants should think twice before filling a baby's bottle with airplane tap water. Just said it doesn't sound like a very good idea. So if you're flying, maybe stay away from the coffee or the tea or airplane tap water. If you can, do it. Probably wouldn't be a big deal in a lot of cases, but there could be some problems. The bottled stuff is always better. And so that's something to think about if you are flying here in the near future. Today is the 20th of June. A couple of things to mention that happened on this day in history, or a few things, I should say. 1782, on this day, the U.S. Congress approved the Great Seal of the United States. I'm sure you're familiar with that. What does it mean? The color white is a symbol of purity and innocence. That really doesn't sound like the U.S. today, but that's what it stood for originally. The red represents hardiness and valor. The blue signifies vigilance, perseverance, and justice, which is interesting. We all know the colors are red, white, and blue. I guess I never stopped to think what they symbolize. And on the seal above the eagle's head is a cloud surrounding a blue field containing 13 stars, which form a constellation. So that's the Great Seal of the United States, 1782. The U.S. Congress approved it. It'd be interesting to see if they had any other ones that didn't get approved. We are all familiar, I think, with the one that did. 1837, on this day, Queen Victoria ascended the British throne following the death of her uncle, King William IV. Big day there in UK history. 1863, on this day, West Virginia became the 35th state to join the U.S. Welcome aboard. Only 1.1% of the state's residents, as of a few years ago anyway, were foreign-born, placing West Virginia last among the 50 states in that statistic. It also has the lowest percentage of residents that speak a language other than English in the home, only 2.7%. So I don't know if that's changed much lately. A lot of immigration in the United States, especially from with people that don't speak English as a first language. But there in West Virginia, they have the least amount of those that segment of the population. The five largest ancestry groups in West Virginia are German, 18.9%, Irish, American, I wonder why they consider people to be American, English, Italian, and the 2000 census, people who identify their ethnicity as simply American made up 18.7% of the population. There we go. That's the answer. I should have just waited a second. They're asked people what they were, and they said American, so even though they have different ancestry originally, for most of them, I would assume. What's your ancestry? American. 1963, on this day, the United States and Soviet Union signed an agreement to set up a hotline communication link between the two countries. I thought that was interesting because just over the weekend, Russia said it's no longer going to have this communication link as far as air travel is concerned. They're in Syria because Americans shot down a Syrian jet. And so they said they're not going to communicate with us anymore over there. But in 1963, we had an agreement to set up a hotline, probably in relation to a lot of things. But over the weekend, they got rid of at least the communication there in Syria, or they said they will. 1997, on this day, one last one, the tobacco industry agreed to a massive settlement in exchange for major relief from mounting lawsuits and legal bills. Of course, the thinking about cigarettes has changed a lot over the years. If you look at old movies, old television shows, or advertisements, it was considered to be a very popular thing to do and promoted, sometimes even like a healthy thing to do. And then, of course, we've learned over the years that it was a horrible thing to do. But people are still smoking. Not as many as they used to be, but there still are some. Cigarette smoking is a leading cause of preventable disease and death in the United States. Still, which I find to be somewhat surprising, even going through school myself, which is, you know, not that long ago, there was all the anti-smoking campaigns, even though kids still smoked, I guess. But it seemed like less and less, but still a lot of people smoking. Still the leading cause of preventable disease and death in the United States, accounting for more than 480,000 deaths every year, or one of every five deaths. That's pretty amazing. In 2015, about 15 of every 100 U.S. adults age 18 or older, 15.1%, currently smoke cigarettes. And this means an estimated 36.5 million adults in the United States currently smoke cigarettes. More than 16 million Americans live with smoking-related diseases. So in spite of all the knowledge now about how bad it is, it still is out there. It's still happening, although it is coming down somewhat. Current smoking has declined a bit. Nearly 21 out of every 100 adults in 2005 smoked, and now it's about 15 out of every 100 adults. Well, that was in 2015. Those are the most recent statistics. So it's down from 20% to 15% of the U.S. population of adults. But people still smoking cigarettes, even though knowing that there's going to be problems. You probably see the commercials where they're advertising methods to try to help people quit. Obviously, the best advice is to never start in the first place, because then you don't have to try to quit it. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we'd love to have you join at kpcgfm. It's easy. It's free. Also, you can email us comments at kpcg.fm, and we're happy to take a look at those for you. Key of David program's coming up here in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, live from Edmond, Oklahoma, where we're broadcasting, the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. Live today. Make sure you do listen for that coming up here in just a bit. And, of course, the archives are available online at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. In case you missed part of it or a past episode, you can get those. One of the topics today he talked about was being rich toward God, and not so much concerned about the accumulation of physical wealth as the first and foremost thought. And which is something people struggle with, of course, especially in a society that has a lot of prosperity and a lot of money. So a really important program there. And related to that, here's some interesting information from a website, moneyish.com. Five facts that prove Americans are terrible at managing money. So we have a lot of money and a lot of things, but here are five facts that prove, unfortunately, Americans are terrible at managing the money. Number one, they say about one in four literally have no emergency savings. And that's what they mean, literally none. Like not a penny, not a dollar. A survey released Tuesday by Bankrate.com found that 24% don't even have a single dollar saved for an emergency. And that's just one of many surveys showing how little we have saved. A survey released in January by Bankrate found that nearly 60% of Americans wouldn't have enough savings to pay for a $500 expense if it came up unexpectedly. And more than that, more than one in five say they'd use their credit card to pay that expense, and more than one would mooch off of family. So apparently their family has saved some money, or they think they have. Experts, of course, recommend that Americans have at least 3 to 6 months of income in the bank to pay for unexpected emergencies. But many people are not doing that well with that. Here's another fact they say proving Americans are terrible at managing money. Five facts. This is the second one. They say we are more worried about paying for our next vacation than about saving enough for retirement. That's a finding of a study released this week by Country Financial, in which Americans report being more concerned about affording that vacation than having adequate retirement savings. That may explain in part why more than half of Americans will be broke when they retire, according to a survey from GoBankingRates.com. So I think that's just human nature, right, to want to be concerned about the nearest thing as opposed to the thing that's down the road in the future or the event. It's a habit. It's hard to break sometimes. Third fact showing Americans are not good at managing money. Millions of people in the U.S. hide money from their spouses and partners. An estimated 12 million Americans confess they have kept a source of money secret. Wow, there you go. That's typically not smart, according to experts. Anytime you get into those kinds of things, you're operating behind the scenes. It usually comes out at some point. That would cause some problems. I guess unless it was all saved up, that would seem not so bad. You know, hey, something I've been meaning to tell you, I saved $1 million. I wouldn't be upset by that at all, but it could be a problem. Number four, fact they say showing Americans are not good with money. We prioritize, they say, paying the wrong bills first. When Americans can't pay the bills, they make bad choices about which to pay. They say consumers in financial distress tend to prioritize unsecured personal loans ahead of other credit products such as auto loans, mortgages, and credit cards. According to a study of roughly 2 million consumers who had all four types of debt, and experts say that it's backwards way to handle the bills. You should pay the important ones first. I guess your mortgages and things like that. Number five, finally, they say, the last fact showing Americans are not good with money. They say the U.S. Residents have racked up $1 trillion in credit card debt. That's just a fraction of what's owed. According to a data released this year from the Federal Reserve, found that the U.S. consumers owe $1.0004 trillion on their cards. That's up 6.2% from a year ago. This is the highest amount owed since January of 2009. And you remember what happened around that time. There was the economic meltdown happened a little bit earlier, but people really struggled in some cases. They say, what's more, this isn't the only consumer debt to top $1 trillion. We now also owe more than $1 trillion for our cars and for our student loans, the data showed. So $3 trillion altogether, plus when you consider credit cards, car loans, and student loans. So not a good situation there. Even though there's a lot of prosperity in the U.S., there's a lot of debt as well. That's from Money-ish, five facts that prove Americans are terrible at managing money. You don't have to be in that situation, of course. There's a lot of good information about money management at thetrumpet.com that you can find in the literature section. And then also this Trumpet Daily Radio Show from today, hosted by Stephen Fleury, Being Rich Toward God, and gets into just the right attitude about finances and materialism and all of that. And getting the priorities right. So that's a great program today, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. Top story is a video trumpet talk. This is a little bit of a newer video segment. It's been going on for, I guess, a month or so. India's entrance into the SCO boosts Russia's power relative to China's, with India now a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Russia may soon be calling more of the shots. That's by Jeremiah Jacques. And so you can watch that video there related to that. Shanghai security bloc now covers nearly half of humanity. And another really good write-up to look at, Russia and China in Prophecy. What can you expect to see from that region over there? That's a must-read at thetrumpet.com. Also in the headlines section of thetrumpet.com, Modern Family, more courts allowing three parents of one child. Saw this headline yesterday. Really bizarre situation. Can you imagine that? You're a child and you have three parents. How is that possible, you're thinking? Well, you probably have some good ideas as to how that's possible. You can read that headline there at thetrumpet.com. It's from the Wall Street Journal. It's a sign of where we're going today. Also, Afghanistan, It's Too Late, New York Review of Books. That's there at thetrumpet.com as well. And then this other headline, which is just astounding in light of the shooting at that congressional baseball practice last week. This headline from NTK Network, and it's at thetrumpet.com. Sanders, Bernie Sanders, he says, act in unprecedented ways, fight back in every way that you can. So some pretty inflammatory comments coming out, even when the dust hasn't really settled from that last shooting there last week. So make sure you check out those headlines at the trumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. I'm Dwight Falk. Thanks for joining me today. Here's a really interesting story in a lot of ways. If you like treasure hunting, finding things, this will be exciting. If you're interested in history, Where did the Nazis go after World War II? You'll be interested in this as well. Nazi artifacts found in Argentina probably shouldn't be a surprise. There's plenty of history showing that Nazis went there to South America and different places. They say Argentine authorities believe they have found the biggest collection of Nazi artifacts in the country's history, including a bust relief of Adolf Hitler and even a macabre medical device used to measure head size, which apparently they were into doing. Of course, you know, they did a lot of pretty grotesque medical experiments and such in that regime, and so that's, I think, somewhat related to that. They say the find was made in recent days when a police raid revealed the stash in a hidden room in a house near Argentina's capital. Just like out of a mystery novel. You find a hidden room, and it has all this, I guess you'd call it treasure in it. It's historically interesting, at least. They say some 75 objects were found in a collector's home in Becar, a suburb north of Buenos Aires, and authorities say they suspect they are originals that belong to high-ranking Nazis in Germany during World War II. Among the disturbing items were toys that Bullrich said would have been used to indoctrinate children, a large statue of the Nazi eagle above a swastika, a Nazi hourglass, and a box of harmonicas. So I'm not sure why they'd have a box of harmonicas there, but they say police say one of the most compelling pieces of evidence of the historical importance of the find is a photo negative of Hitler holding a magnifying glass similar to those found in the boxes. They say it is the original magnifying glass that Hitler was using, according to Argentina's federal police head. So they have some pretty amazing artifacts there of historical import. And they're there in Argentina. This particular photograph of Hitler, they say, was not released to the public, but was shown to the Associated Press on the condition that it not be published. I wonder where it's going to go. Like, who's going to keep all this stuff? I suppose a museum or something. The investigation that culminated in the discovery of the collection began when authorities found artworks of illicit origin in a gallery in North Buenos Aires. Agents with the International Police Force, Interpol, began following the collector, and with a judicial order, raided the house on the 8th of June, and, of course, found this hidden room with all of this Nazi paraphernalia in it. A large bookshelf caught their attention, and behind it, agents found a hidden passageway to a room filled with Nazi imagery. It is truly like some sort of a mystery novel, treasure-hunting novel. Authorities did not identify the collector, who remains free, but he's under investigation. I suppose they're going to wonder, where did you get this stuff from? Police are trying to determine how the artifacts entered Argentina. The main hypothesis, though, is this. Among investigators and members of the Argentina's Jewish community, their hypothesis is that they were brought to Argentina by a high-ranking Nazi or Nazis after World War II, when the South American country became a refuge for fleeing war criminals, including some of the best known. So there is plenty of, I guess, proof that many of them went there, escaped punishment, escaped at least for a time. Sometimes maybe they escaped permanently, you know, from answering for their crimes in World War II. They got out of town. How did they do it? Well, that's an interesting story, too, but not something to get into now. As leading members, this article says, of Hitler's Third Reich were put on trial for war crimes. Joseph Mengele fled to Argentina and lived in Buenos Aires for a decade. He moved to Paraguay after Israeli Mossad agents captured Holocaust mastermind Adolf Eichmann, who was also living in Buenos Aires. So this other fellow later died, Mengele, in Brazil in 1979. So he was there all the way up until that time. While police in Argentina did not name any high-ranking Nazis to whom the objects might have originally belonged, Bullrich noted there were medical devices. Ariel Cohen Sabin, president of the DAIA, political umbrella for Argentina's Jewish institutes, called the find unheard of in Argentina. So maybe there'll be more information about that, where they can go and find out exactly who the stuff belonged to. Maybe it was several individuals, but of course there's always been a lot of information about out there about, I think, the Nazis, some of them escaping, going to South America and maybe other places too. Sometimes even here in the United States, you'll hear about somebody getting found out for having been involved somehow in that regime. So people did get out of Germany. They did go and hide, sometimes successfully. And in this case, they found this huge trove of artifacts, Nazi artifacts, and they were found in Argentina. And they say, really, they have found things like this in the past, but in a lot of cases, they are they're fakes. They're not originals. In this case, they think they're originals. So somebody had all that stuff with them. And it's interesting, too, if you think about, I don't know exactly how much stuff they had, but the picture they showed was, I think, of the big, well, they showed some of it, and it was fairly large. You know, how did they get it down there? You think about fleeing, I guess you tend to think about, or I would tend to think, like running with, you know, not being able to carry much, but they had a lot of stuff with them. So it seems pretty coordinated and pretty organized, and they were able to get some of their artifacts that they found, thought were valuable, down there to Argentina. So how did that happen exactly? Pretty interesting. Probably some good ideas about out there about how it did happen, but really interesting story. There's a lot about that out today. And some good pictures of different websites you can go and find where they show some of what they found there, some of those Nazi artifacts in Argentina. Well, this year I think we've had a few stories that have come out about sharks, and it seems like there's been more shark attacks than normal on some of the coastal areas. There's been sharks out in California, Southern California, and a few other places, and a few attacks. Here's a quick little note about that. How did sharks become so scary? Not in the sense of them looking scary and attacking like they are, but how did they become scary where people are afraid of them? They say summer hasn't even officially begun. This is from Time Magazine. But sightings of great white sharks in shallow waters have already forced beach closures on both U.S. coasts. In a post-Jaws world, and you know Jaws, that infamous movie, I guess, it would seem only natural that shark warnings would send swimmers running, they say, but that hasn't always been the case. For most of history, in fact, sharks simply weren't on most people's radars as something to fear, which I've always known sharks to be something you should be afraid of, but apparently that wasn't always the case. They say it's not all Hollywood's fault either. Experts point to July 1916 when a series of shark attacks on the Jersey Shore killed four people and left one injured as a turning point when people began to become more terrified of sharks. They say people were so afraid of what became known as the Jersey Man-Eater that President Woodrow Wilson held a cabinet meeting at which he advocated for killing all sharks on the East Coast. I don't think that would fly today. I don't think they could do it. They say the reason for the concentrated spate of shark attacks remains a mystery. Why they caused the national panic is easier to understand. The beach would have been particularly crowded due to a combination of unusual heat that month and a lack of air conditioning back there in July 1916. And so there'd be a lot of people out there on the beach. The fact that it happened near New York City may have also helped the news to get to the president. While fears of unprovoked shark attacks are common, attacks themselves are not. According to George Burgess, director of the Florida Museum of Natural History's International Shark Attack File, there are only on average 6 shark caused fatalities worldwide each year. So that's not that many. But they always make the headlines when it happens. And I think probably because of Jaws and that event there in July 1916, I believe it was, people are concerned about sharks. And rightfully so. So there have been a few attacks this year and on the coast and some sightings also. One last story to look at today, and have you ever felt like you might be addicted to sugar? Well, they say there's not actually that many people addicted to it as they would call true sugar addicts. I don't know how they would term that or how they would figure out if you were a true sugar addict, but they say about 10% of the U.S. population are true sugar addicts. So I'm not sure exactly, again, how they're qualifying that. Probably, it seems to me like it would be higher than that, but that's what they say anyway, so we'll go with their information. But this is a write-up from CNN. They talked to a nutritionist about detoxing from sugar. Obviously, there's so much sugar in the modern diet, and if people stop having as much, it will be better. And that's just, I think, pretty common sense. So, but the question is, how do you get people to stop having sugar? Well, this nutritionist says, what was so successful in getting my clients to kick their sugar habit was to go cold turkey. You heard that right. Just stop doing it for 3 days. Anyway, she says. When they would go cold turkey, she says, I wasn't their favorite person. But the number one positive effect was that it recalibrated their palate. So that's really interesting. Maybe you've done this before intentionally or accidentally. I think I did it accidentally one time where if I would go to, say, a Starbucks or something, they always want to put syrup in the drinks to different flavors. And so I would have those. And then one time I decided, well, I'm going to stop doing that. I don't want all that syrup in there. So I just stopped having it. And then now if they accidentally put it in there, I can barely drink it. I mean, it just tastes terrible to me. And just so strong. But it's so interesting to think about how it used to not even register. Like, I didn't even taste it before because my palate was so out of whack with that. But so they say, this nutritionist says, if you just stop having sugar, the best you can anyway, I guess, for 3 days, it recalibrates the palate. You actually start tasting things again. She says they could now, her clients that would do this, after the sugar detox, she says they could now taste natural sugars and fruits, vegetables and dairy that they used to be so dulled to. So it got to the point where having an apple was like eating a piece of candy, if you can imagine that. Apples, I don't think, taste as sweet to most people because of all the sugars that we often consume. But when these people were able to, these clients of hers, go off of sugar for 3 days, their palates recalibrated. She says, once the first 3 days of the sugar detox are completed, then add something, like an apple. So she's advocating not going back on these processed things, but trying to have something natural. And it does taste a lot sweeter than it has in the past because, again, the palate is recalibrated. So that's a pretty interesting thing to try if you've got the courage. She says, an apple tastes like candy. Onions are sweet. Almonds are sweet. Once you take away sugar away from your diet, cold turkey, your palate recalibrates. You start tasting those natural sugars again. And, of course, if we're having a lot of unnatural sugars, I don't think we even taste the other sugars anymore. Not like we should. One of the benefits of detoxing from sugar is that it can help you lose weight quickly. According to this nutritionist, they said they had over 80 testers from all over the country, and they lost anywhere from between 5 to 20 pounds during the first 31 days, depending on their weight or sugar addiction. Many also noticed that a lot of weight was lost from their midsection. That's always what people are hoping to do, is lose weight from the midsection. And not having sugar really does change that. Participants also reported that they had brighter eyes, clearer skin, fewer dark circles. They also had more energy and fewer mood swings. So all positive results from trying to eliminate sugar. And there are some, I suppose, temporary drawbacks depending on how much the body is used to sugar or how much it's craving it. But these do pass. Depending, they say, on how intense your addiction is, you can experience withdrawal symptoms such as brain fog, crankiness, and fatigue, otherwise known as Monday. I added that part, Albert said. They found that the children in the study experienced anxiety and irritability during the first 5 days of eliminating sugar and caffeine, though it eventually subsided. And they say, if you feel bad, stop and have a piece of fruit, talking about during, like, say, this detox period. But if you can push through and stay well hydrated, you can really break your cycle of sugar addiction. And, of course, you've probably seen the statistics lately or heard about them. There is an obesity epidemic in the world, particularly in the Western world. It's affecting children as well. And a lot of it comes down to the food and the sugar that people are consuming. And it's in a lot of things, you know. And then they even have, on this particular article, this sequence of slides where they show you how much sugar people are having on average, but they break it down. They put it into like a pile of cookies, you know, or things like that where you really understand how much you're having. And, of course, you'd look at that and think, I would never sit down and eat that that stack of cookies. But that's how much sugar comes in throughout the day in a variety of sources. So anyway, that's what some nutritionists say. Maybe go cold turkey for a few days and see if you can kick the habit, recalibrate the palate, and then introduce some things that are more natural, and they end up tasting sweeter to you. So not a bad idea to maybe try it. But again, sometimes there can be some drawbacks there, maybe for the first few days, depending on how much you're used to it. So I think that's a good point. A lot of good health write-ups at thetrumpet.com, also at pcog.org, if you're interested in learning more about that. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show is coming up in a bit here on KPCG. Also, the Key of David program. Make sure you listen for those. And also, make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. Again, the top headline is Trumpet Talk video, India's entrance into the SCO boosts Russia's power relative to China's. Really interesting video there, and a topic maybe you haven't heard a lot about just in the mainstream media, I guess, but very important. So make sure you check that out. Related to that, also Russia and China in prophecy. You can find that at allatthetrumpet.com, and it's free, of course, so make sure you do stop and check that out. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, thanks for joining me on this Tuesday. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.